This is Keep It Juicy, episode 16. Hello and welcome to Keep It Juicy, a weekly podcast that features experts on living a juicy life. What's a juicy life? It's a lifestyle for those who have put in a few miles and are ready to turn off-road, who are still learning and excited, who are fearless, or who are scared but dare anyway. Juicies are grown-ups, so some of our language may not be appropriate for children. Juicies are bold, passionate, and ready to squeeze every drop of juice out of life. I'm your host, Helen Mitternight. Are you ready? Let's keep it juicy. I'm your host, Helen Mitternight. When you opened your eyes this morning, how long did it take you to check your email or social media? If you're like me, the answer is an embarrassing less than 5 minutes. I get anxious if I feel like things are happening and I don't know about them. Today's guest, psychotherapist and mindfulness teacher Nancy Collier, says we have a digital addiction. In her book, The Power of Off, Nancy talks about the importance of unplugging. She talks today about what's fueling the addiction and how to kick it, well, or at least long enough to get in touch with yourself. Nancy Collier on today's Keep It Juicy. Nancy, welcome. Thank you so much for being at Keep It Juicy.
So glad to be here.
So I wanted to ask you, because I was looking at the materials you sent, and you started out as a professional equestrian. How did you go from that to focusing on mindfulness?
Right. We all have these crazy paths, don't we? So I rode on the circuit for about 25 years and kept my amateur status, actually, because I wanted to keep competing. But, top-level sport is really about mindfulness at the core, because we all get to a place, well, not all of us, but you get to a place where you are supremely capable in terms of physically what you're able to do. And then there's this piece, grace, I guess you could call it, where you are so present in the moment as you're riding around a course of jumps, that you can notice if you've lost just a minute amount of, let's say, weight in the left calf or pressure in the right pinky. And all these things as an equestrian will combine together to create the best jump that the horse takes. And so it teaches you, beyond teaching you incredible sense of self and in sense of courage, and that you've got yourself to depend on. You know, when the going gets really tough, when you're walking in that ring and you know you can dig deep inside yourself and pull out something, even though you're really anxious or even though it's whatever it is. But also, so there's that piece of courage, but also this piece of total presence that is, was my sort of first initiation into the zone experience or the flow experience. So you need that level of presence. And that's what really distinguishes those who reach a certain physical level to those who really succeed. And being a great athlete is at its more subtle levels very much about, where is your mind? What's happening in your mind? It's not really at a certain point about just your body. And, another thing, when you're in flow experience, there's that incredible thing that happens, which is that you, the separate you, disappears. So there's no one doing the activity. There's just the activity. There's just the experience. And then when you're done, oh, darn, there has to be a me here now returning, it feels like. Flow is the disappearance of your separateness from life. And for me, that was so, God, there's no other place you'd want to be. There just is no other place. And we can get there in any number of ways, but it brought me into a curiosity and a conversation with mindfulness, and it kind of went from there.
And I would think, I mean, I've ridden a couple of horses in my life, and I would think that the horses, because they give you such immediate feedback and they're so tuned into your moods, that that's even easier to make that connection.
You know, I mean, my experience just from, you know, 30 years in the saddle or 40 years, whatever, 30. Yeah, no, I started more than 40 years. Is yes, horses most definitely pick up on your anxiety or pick up on where you are sort of emotionally. But this piece of being present as you go around the course, and the kind of riding I did was about the beauty, making the horse jump in the best style that they could. I didn't particularly take to the speed classes. So what I excelled at was this ability to be sort of seamless in a course of jumps. And the horse, what happens is if you lose presentness, you'll start to anticipate the jump. So as you go around a course, you have to be just as present in the moments between the jumps as you do over the jumps. And if you lose presentness, you start rushing to the jump. And that applies to life because, you know, if we're not present in the gaps between activities, we start to think that the gaps between activities or gaps between noise or gaps between movement, the doing, is the only place that matters. And we lose touch with the being, with the spaces in between the thoughts, the silence behind the noise, all these. So it's riding is the most amazing teacher for life you could ever know. All the same things present, and it gives you an opportunity to use the ring as your teacher.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about electronic devices, because I have to tell our listeners that we had a little bit of a technological glitch this morning, and I was sort of thinking that it was the karma gods of electronic devices taking their revenge on us. But you're advocating for, well, first of all, you're saying that we're sort of addicted to our electronic devices, right? And what's fueling that addiction?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing. You know, I started, before I wrote The Power of Off, I was really looking at how do we stay well in this digitally mad world? And how do we raise a happy family? How do we sort of know how to still maintain some sense of well-being while everything is moving so quickly and, you know, we're 24/7 available and all that sort of stuff? And as I did more research, I kept bumping into the research that says technology addiction is no different than any other substance addiction. It in all the MRI studies, in all the brain studies that we've been doing, they are showing that to start, what happens when you use is you get a real hit of dopamine. And dopamine is the pleasure hormone. It's what we feel, what gets released when we feel good. And so the body says, oh, I want more of that. And it sets off this reward cycle where the body starts craving that chemical. But then very shortly after that, what happens is that when we can't, let's say we get a notification, but we can't get to it yet, or we start thinking about something we need to do online, but we can't do it yet. Then we get the feedback on the other side, which is cortisol. And that's the fight or flight hormone. That's the stress hormone. So we're in this constant cycle of dopamine, cortisol, dopamine, cortisol. And that's no different than heroin. That's no different than cocaine. That's no different than drinking. The thing is, this addiction is really more like an eating disorder because, again, we can't get off technology and we don't want to, frankly, because there's lots of yummy stuff in technology, but we have to learn how to find freedom in technology, not from it. Freedom inside it, where we're making the choices. I will say too, Helen, that one of the main things, though, that's quite different about this addiction, and it's troubling, because in other addictions, if you are using too much, sooner or later, you're going to lose your family, you're going to lose your job, you know, it's going to make you an outsider in life. And as we know, in this addiction, we've all drunk the Kool-Aid. We're all in. So it makes you an insider to be addicted. And it makes you sort of, as with the younger generation, with millennials and so on, it makes you, you know, socially a player, if you will. It makes you the hipster to be on 24/7 and part of every conversation. So our relationship with this addiction is working against us. Another thing that's a little bit different about this addiction that is also troubling to those of us that are experts in the field is with other addictions, you know, we didn't have, well, I'll just say what's true now. We have all these brilliant addiction specialists and brilliant brain scientists, and they're being hired by some of the behemoth, the, you know, the Facebook, the Instagrams, the Snapchatters, by the companies, not to help us with our addictions, but to make us addicted, to how can we get them hooked. And so all the things you see, you know, in your social media, for example, how long it takes for that little notification to come up, or, you know, the streaks that were created by Snapchat, there are many, many, many devices that the companies are using based on the best research about the human brain and what creates addiction. You know, that intermittent reward cycle that the gambler experiences when he goes on the slot machine, that's all been studied. How often do we need to give that gambler a cha-ching, a win, so that he'll stay on? Same thing with this addiction. They have figured out, how do we keep your eyes on our screen? Because addiction's good for business. So that's problematic. And what I was really excited to see, I will say, is this recent week, how Jhana Partners, a big investor in Apple, is now demanding that they take some responsibility for the addiction that they have not, you know, they've co-created with the human being. And how can they get involved to stop it?
I did see that too. But that, boy, that's a lot to unpack. And I want to ask you something that was sort of in the middle of what you were saying, because some people feel lonely in life and their social media is their group, their tribe. So how do they... I mean, if it's the drug of choice. I mean, if we're comparing this to any other addiction, and this online life is the drug of choice, if it makes you feel connected, which is supposed to be a good thing for humans, how do you tell the difference between the healthy interactions and the addictive interactions?
So the thing that happens with social media, and even Facebook has now come out and acknowledged that, you know, the trend is turning where the big guys are and women are acknowledging, wait a minute, maybe some of this is not so good. So to answer your question, when people are using social media, no, they're not falling down drunk in gutters. No, they're not, you know, stumbling to get crack cocaine. But what we're finding is that in the very, very, very short term, there's a kind of relief. There's a sense of, okay, I'm not alone, right? But what happens, and this has been backed up by thousands now of studies, is that ultimately, that way of communicating leads to the sense, the experience of loneliness. And then not only loneliness, but But there's the double hit there where I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. I'm using more and more and more to try and get that feeling of connectivity. But what it's actually doing is making me feel emptier and emptier. So it doesn't work for the thing we're trying to use it for. You know, we believed at the beginning of this technological revolution that more communication would make us feel more connected, and it's failed. Mm-hmm. What we're finding is that the more people spend time on internet connectivity and are getting their community from the computer, the less time that they're going out into the world and having face-to-face interactions. And that the loneliness rates have gone in the last 10 years from 11% to 40% of reported loneliness.
Wow.
Not working.
You know what I found a little, well, more than a little frightening is you always hear that there are people who are more prone to addiction, their addictive personalities or whatever. And so you might think, okay, I'm going to go in and I'm not prone to being addicted. So I'm going to be fine, except that your social media sites are learning from your own behavior and making themselves shinier and more attractive to your own unique buttons, right?
And that's what's terrifying.
Yeah.
That is what is terrifying. So they're watching very closely. How does this unique animal get addicted, and how do we figure that out? And it's not to, you know, create a conspiracy theory. They've acknowledged that they're trying to figure out how to up our time spent looking at their particular app or what have you. So what's the good news is that the mythology is kind of cracking, where we're realizing a lot of the things that we thought were true about technology, that it makes life easier. Most people say, you know what? I can't even manage the amount of data I need to manage. I can't even bear to figure out another sort of job I now need to do because there are no humans anymore doing them. You know, I can't navigate another whole universe. What we're finding is it doesn't really make life easier. In fact, it just adds so much that we need to do. Does it make life more connected? Well, we just talked about that. What we're finding is, you know, online community cannot replace face-to-face community. It's not that you can't add that to face-to-face community, but what the way people are using, which is as a replacement, it doesn't work. I mean, one interesting statistic, which I'll just throw in there, which is in 2000, 50% of our non-work, non-sleep time, non-chores too, was spent doing social, like media and screen and all that social media stuff. By 2007, 66% of our non-work, non-sleep time was going to computer-related activities. What do you think the number was in 2017?
Gosh, I'm afraid to guess. What?
It should be 90%. So 90% of our free time, that's the time we do hobbies, that's the time we have a spiritual practice, that's the time we go out and meet friends for coffee, going to online behavior. So what's happening, so again, this myth that it makes life more connected and that, oh, it just enhances our face-to-face, not the way we're using it. And then another myth, you know, fundamentally, that it makes life better. Well, if you know, I've done hundreds and hundreds of interviews, and it's not really what I find. In fact, it's quite the opposite, that while our world has changed tremendously, the things human beings need to feel well, to have a good life, they haven't changed a smidge. You know, connection, sense of something larger, sense of engaged work, sense that we're part of something that is our community, the sense of being present and in one's life, the sense of living an authentic life that is your unique sort of what you can offer this world. All these things that people come up with consistently, none of them have anything to do with what we get from technology. And if anything, as those statistics show, they take away from our activities that actually enhance those things we really need. So good news, the mythology is cracking and people are saying, wait a minute, I'm not sure this is really offering us all the juicy stuff. And how do we take the reins back? That's the thing. How do we get back so that it's not our inner reptile, our inner addict, who's holding the reins in our relationship, but it's the more evolved human that says, you know, what's really important to me? That's the one that we want reading. Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I want to ask you next is the, okay, how do we turn off? But I want to ask one more question, which is, do you see any kind of a gender difference? I mean, I just wonder, you know, women are used to being on call and having multi demands pulling at them. I don't know if that makes them better able to resist or if it makes them not better able to resist. I just don't know.
Well, the only gender real problems I've seen is that boys in the younger generations are more pulled towards the gaming. That's their addictive tendency. And girls are pulled to the social media, which is no surprise. You know, we have the relational and then we have the sort of gaming, you know. But what I've found is that this is non-gender specific. This is really about the human being. And our values, our basic values changing as a world, I guess you could say, or certainly as a Western world country, in the sense that character and discipline and hard work and these sorts of things, they're really not at the top of the list right now. We're really more interested in ease or popularity. Or speed. So what we're finding is that when we value these kinds of things, you know, we are being more and more drawn to live our lives by those values, even though they don't nourish us and they don't feed us. But men and women alike are susceptible to these changing values in the sense of, you know, let's say in the workplace, 24/7 availability is rewarded. You know, you're a good employer. I like working with you because you're always reachable, right? So everyone is susceptible to that because that hits how we make a living. Or, you know, some of these other senses of, I have to respond immediately to every single text that comes to me, like within 30 seconds. 90% of people feel they have to respond immediately, like they couldn't be doing something else. That's across the board, men and women, that there's, but of course, you know, there's always going to be for women more of that relational sort of people pleasing aspect, which social media and all the rest kicks up. But it's pretty across the board, male, female.
Huh. Okay. So what's the solution? Because it's not practical to say, you know, total detox, right?
No, of course not. You know, the solution starts, people always come to me and they say, all right, give me the list. So what do I do? Just, you know, how do I do this differently? And I'm always laughing because the first step is really a question of, I call it spiritual autonomy. But it's essentially taking responsibility for your life, which is to stop and recognize at a very basic level, I'm not okay with the way I'm living with technology or relating with it. Or, you know, a woman came in last week and she said, you know, I met a dear friend, you know, for a coffee the other day. And the first thing I did was put my phone, you know, on the table in between us, in case something came in. And she said, I had one of those aha moments where I said, wait a minute. This friend I haven't seen in, you know, months, and here I am putting my phone on the table. And so we have to have our moment of saying, it's not working for me the way I'm doing this, right? It can't just be a kind of, isn't this interesting? And when we have that sense that there's something funky about my relationship with technology, or a woman who came to me also fairly recently, and she said, you know, she's a top level corporate executive. She gets 2,000 emails a day. She's completely, you know, crazed and available. And she said, you know, the only way I can keep myself from using my phone at night when I'm with my husband is if I lock it in my car and I give him the keys. That's the only way I can do it. And I'm not okay with that. I'm not okay with that level of helplessness. So the first step in getting better is a recognition that there's something out of alignment here in the way I'm using. I had an aha moment. One day I had come back from a long day of seeing patients and my two girls were there, and I gave them a quick perfunctory hello, kiss on the top of the head, and then I went straight to email. And I was standing in email, not like I was expecting anything spectacular. And I had that moment where I said, oh my God, you know, how is my life and my behavior so out of alignment with what actually matters to me? So we start by saying, maybe writing a list even and saying, okay, turn everything off. What matters to me? Where is my priority in my heart? Where is my priority in my spirit? You know, what at the end of this life, what actually matters to me? Maybe it's a sense of a way I want to be, or maybe it's the people, or whatever it is. And then to do a real inventory of, am I using my time and attention, which are our greatest, those are our assets, those are our greatest things that we're given. Am I using my time and attention in a way that fits with what matters to me? That's number one. And then we start to ask questions. So every time we have the impulse to use that habitual sort of addictive tendency, we don't shame and blame ourselves that, you know, Facebook has got us, you know, it worked, okay. But what we do is we stop, like any addict, and we pause and we say, what would I have to feel here if I didn't use? And by doing that every time, if we can, we recognize, first of all, why am I really using? Is it for work? Is that really true? Is it just habit? Is it boredom? Is it what it does is it completely flips our relationship with technology. So rather than something that puts us to sleep, so we just habitually use and we just get on and then the next 3 hours are gone, you know, with Candy Crush or what have you, it allows us to say, oh, the impulse to use tells me I need to look at this moment and what does it feel like is missing? Or what's happening here that I'm wanting to distract myself from this moment? So we use it just the opposite as a wake-up call. And then we can get into, after those two things kind of can marinate a little in you, that we set our priority list, we take a good hard look at, am I living in alignment with that? And then we sort of make a deal that we'll just pause when we get the impulse to use. We can still use, but that we take that extra breath and say, what's happening here? So rather than technology being a way we leave the present moment, it becomes an invitation into the present moment. Then I give you a whole bunch of things that we can do, very basic things. And I can, you know, in the book, The Power of Off, there is a 30-day detox, and every day you get a different behavior that you can address. Some are adding things like adding a body practice or adding silence or adding downtime, all of which are disappearing in this digital world. These things that we, the nervous system desperately needs, you know, as a therapist and a researcher and all these sorts of things, they're just certain, they're no brainers in our field that downtime and silence are absolutely necessary to the animal human. And so, let me know if there's more you'd like me to, I can be very specific about some of the behaviors, or just to start with those two as a discussion.
I think starting with those two is a lot. And just for the listeners, I will have a link on the website to Nancy's book so that you can delve much deeper yourself too. I thank you. And now I'm inspired, Nancy, to turn off my Facebook, which is sounds almost painful, to be honest.
Does it?
Yes.
Yeah. So what does Facebook do for you?
Well, I feel, you know, I started out as a reporter for the Associated Press, and I would sit next to the wire machine, and I would get the news as it came in before anyone else. All the headlines.
Oh, wow.
You know, back in those days when they had, you know, but it was like there was a computer, but it was very, very basic. And it was an actual wire machine with paper coming out. And that sense of knowing before anybody else and being plugged in is the same kind of levers that Facebook pushes for me.
Wow. And that's it.
Yeah.
And what happens when you take a pause? Do you notice what the felt sense is when you don't do that?
Yeah, I get anxious that I'm missing out.
That you're missing out.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the things, right, that we're finding is that we the more we use, the more we have this, and I hear that it's already sort of built into you. It's, you know, we're wired certain ways. So you notice you're wired that way. One of the things that these addictions do is that they start to train us that life, it's hard to language, but that life sits outside of us in the happenings, in the events, in the stuff, the content that we, you know, we love now because you can watch, you know, Rachel Maddow for, you know, a marathon. But, and what it does is it starts to, that process you're describing starts to make you feel like where you are without all the stuff, without all the contents, is kind of nowhere, is a void. Mm. So it starts to train you to experience just you as kind of nothing until you got some stuff, you got something for your mind to kind of chew on. And so what ends up happening for someone in that situation is that it takes more and more and more kind of content. And then you get this anxiety that's when you can't get to it, right? Because now where does my mind go? What do I got? You know, what am I missing? What am I missing? And it pulls us further and further away from where we are. And that is actually a complete space, a complete moment, that I am complete without the stuff. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. And I think we're going to have to leave it there just for time. Nancy, thank you so much. So much to think about. And not all of it comfortable.
Right.
Thank you not so much for being here.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
If you want to get Nancy's book about turning off or find out more about Nancy in general, check out the Health Resources page on our website, keepitjuicy.com. You can keep up with us on Facebook and Twitter at keepitjuicy.com, or you can go to the website and sign up for the newsletter. Oh, and it really helps if you go onto iTunes and leave a review. Meanwhile, go out there and keep it juicy.